Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Jean-Paul Sartre, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 7.
Sartre's analysis of human freedom implies that our lives have something of the character of artistic creations. Just as a painter works with given materials, so we're thrown into situations. Our materials are our bodily constitution and capacities, our moment in time, our family and social setting, so on. We don't make these elements of our situation. We do fashion our response to them. We give them the meaning they have for us. Just as the painter must invent, so must we. This creative response, even though we can always change it, defines our individual way of being in the world. It defines our central values as people. Our attitudes and preferences, our desires and fears, what we do and have and make, all express this fundamental project of ours. In this sense, we're responsible for everything we are. Sartre thinks this responsibility reaches very far. For example, we're responsible for things that might seem entirely objective, like our geographical setting, the place where we live and work. While in a sense our placing among things is given to us, we are the ones to give it meaning. We get the place we choose. Sartre asks us to imagine that he's someone who lives and works in the rural town of Mont-de-Marsan.
It would be to no point to say that I'm not free to go to New York because of the fact that I'm a minor government official at Mont-de-Marsan. On the contrary, it is only in relation to my project of going to New York that I'm going to situate myself at Mont-de-Marsan. My placing in the world, the relation of Mont-de-Marsan to New York and to China, would be altogether different if, for example, my project were to become a wealthy farmer at Mont-de-Marsan.
It's only because the man dreams of going to New York that he feels he's stuck in Mont-de-Marsan. He has given this significance to his place. It'd have a different significance if he aimed to be a wealthy farmer, for example. The man might simply be rejecting his present provincial setting, and so he takes up the dream of New York to hide this from himself. In his bad faith, he's made his setting an obstacle. On the other hand, if the man's wholeheartedly set on going to New York, being in Mont-de-Marsan is not necessarily an obstacle at all. In order to go to New York, you have to start from somewhere. The man could see Mont-de-Marsan as a point of departure. It all depends on your end in view.
Thus, I shall apprehend myself at any moment whatsoever as engaged in the world at my contingent place. But it is precisely this engagement which gives meaning to my contingent place and which expresses my freedom.
There is a brute relation of spatial distance, of course, and each thing has a given height and depth. But we give these features an existential meaning.
The mountain is overwhelming if I live at the foot of it. On the other hand, if I am at its peak, the mountain is recovered by the very project of my pride and symbolizes the superiority which I attribute to myself over other men. The brute relation of distance to objects can never be allowed to get its meaning and symbols from outside, for these are our very way of constituting it.
There's also a brute relation to the past. That is, it has an unchangeable element. For example, if you had whooping cough when you were 5 years old, that's just a brute fact. But there's an element which is variable too, namely the meaning you give that brute fact. You couldn't even affirm the reality of your whooping cough without incorporating it within 1,000 projects you had, a certain historical frame of reference, a confident belief in what your parents told you, a whole medical vocabulary, and so on. So the meaning of the past is strictly dependent on your present projects. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that we can make the meaning of our previous acts vary in any way we please. Given our present projects, the meaning of our previous acts will be apparent too. By projecting ourselves towards our ends, we preserve the past with us, and by our actions we decide its meaning.
Who shall decide whether that mystic crisis in my 15th year was a pure accident of puberty, or, On the contrary, the first sign of a future religious conversion. I myself will decide, according to whether I shall decide at 20 years of age or at 30 years, to be converted. The project of conversion by a single stroke confers on an adolescent crisis the value of a premonition, which I had not taken seriously. Who shall decide whether the period which I spent in prison after a theft was fruitful or deplorable? I, according to whether I give up stealing or become hardened.
The meaning of our past depends, then, on our present commitments, and it follows, too, that any historical account of the past depends upon our projects as well. The historian, as he writes his history, is himself historical. He illuminates history in the light of his personal projects and those of his time. Sartre describes how an historian assigns meaning to one of the most famous events of the French Revolution, the storming of the Bastille.
Nobody denies, of course, that the Bastille was taken in 1789. There is the immutable fact. But are we to see in this event a revolt without consequence? A popular outburst against the half-dismantled fortress? An event which those in the National Convention, anxious to create a famous past for themselves, were able to transform into a glorious deed? Or should we consider it as the first manifestation of popular strength by which the populace asserted itself, gave itself confidence, and put itself in a position to effect the march on Versailles?
What really happened when the Bastille was stormed? The answer depends on the historian's interpretation of the event. And since other historians will follow him with new evidence and new points of view, the meaning of the attack on the Bastille keeps getting reworked. Sartre suggests that all human history would have to be finished before a particular event like the taking of the Bastille could have a final definitive meaning. History inevitably gets written and rewritten as we go along.
Thus, it is necessary to say that the meaning of the social past is perpetually in suspense.
Sartre's thesis here about the meaning of the past is the same one he advanced earlier about the meaning of our spatial setting. There is, he believes, a profound reciprocity between our freedom and the conditions which situate it. We are inseparable from the world and the world from us. There is freedom and there are these situating conditions, and each requires the other.
There is freedom only in a situation, and there is a situation only through freedom. Human reality everywhere encounters resistances and obstacles which it has not created. But these resistances and obstacles have meaning only in and through the free choice which human reality is.
But there are other dimensions of our situatedness that we relate to in a somewhat different way. Sartre's already spoken of our conflicted relations to other people. These relations constitute a special dimension of our situation. But our mortality is also an ultimate and limiting condition. As we'll see, Sartre has an unusual understanding of the meaning of mortality and death. We're already prepared for Sartre's basic understanding that we're in a conflicted relation to others. We're confronted with other freedoms, that is, other freely acting people. These people not only resist our freedom, as objects do, but they confront our freedom with an opposing freedom. They objectify us. They make us parts of their worlds. But there's yet a more disconcerting feature here. To deal with parents, friends, or co-workers is one thing. But behind and beyond individuals, the generalized presence of others haunts us on every side. Everything around us has been shaped by general social purposes which are not our own. Our freedom is limited, oriented by this massive presence of objects which reflect the impersonal meanings of our society.
I, by whom meanings come to things, I find myself engaged in an already meaningful world which reflects to me meanings which I have not put into it. One may recall, for example, the innumerable host of meanings which are independent of my choice and which I discover if I live in the city. Streets, houses, shops, streetcars and buses, directing signs, warning sounds, music on the radio, and so on. In solitude, of course, I should discover the brute and unpredictable existence of this rock, for example. And I should limit myself, in short, to making there be a rock there. But when there, where the street curves, I discover a building. It is not only a brute existence which I reveal in the world. I do not only cause there to be a this qualified in this or that way, but the meaning of the object which is revealed then resists me and remains independent of me. I discover that the property is an apartment house, or a group of offices belonging to the gas company, or a prison.
In short, we're hedged all around by objects which embody social meanings. They seem entirely indifferent to us and our projects. To deal with these objects, to even recognize what they are, we need to be familiar with the customs and practices of our society. An apartment house is where people live. The gas company manages a substance used for cooking and heating. The prison's a part of the whole system of criminal justice, and so on. We thus confront an entire social world to which, like language, we must apprentice ourselves. Since this social world imposes meanings on us, it constitutes a special sort of limit to our freedom. But Sartre's chief point is this. The social world is precisely not an external constraint on us, pushing us around. Our individual freedom, again, can be seen to play an essential role. Our freedom can't be separated from our social situation. Sartre uses the example of our relationship to language. Of course, language exists outside us. We find ourselves amidst its words and sentences and subject to its grammatical rules, much as we find ourselves in the city, amidst buildings and streets. But in both cases, we can acquire the skill of using the words and sentences and getting around in the streets. In both cases, we appropriate the general social meanings which are outside us. We interiorize them. In so doing, we go beyond them. They become instruments of our freedom. We learn to speak as we want, just as we learn what the buildings mean and how to follow the city streets to the destination we want. And ultimately, Sartre insists, we can come to see that social realities have their being only because of our actions as individuals.
It is only by speaking that we cause words to exist. And it is within the free project of the sentence that the laws of speech are organized. It is by speaking that I make grammar.
By our freedom, we constitute the constraints which language and the whole system of social values and rules places on us. We enact these constraints and carry along these rules in our personal choices of what to say and do. In our freedom, we can also critically analyze our language and our social structures. We can put them into question. Social reality, then, does set fundamental limits on us, but we continually choose what significance these limits will have. Finally, we come to the most elusive of all the elements Sartre sees in our situatedness, namely our mortality. Sartre treats mortality quite differently from other elements of our situation. We inevitably give meaning to our place, our past, our circumstances, even our social world, but we do not give meaning, we cannot give meaning, to our deaths. Sartre insists that death is an ultimate limit. The absurdity of death marks the ultimate absurdity of our existence. Our conscious existence is the source of meaning for us. We can anticipate the end of our conscious existence only as the removal of all possible meaning. For Sartre, death is meaninglessness. There is no way we can give it meaning, and this is the reality we must try to face.
What must be noted first is the absurd character of death. in this sense, every attempt to consider it as a resolved chord at the end of a melody must be sternly rejected. It has often been said that we are in the situation of a condemned man, among other condemned men, who is ignorant of the day of his execution, but who sees each day that his fellow prisoners are being executed. This is not wholly exact. We ought, rather, to compare ourselves to a man condemned to death who is bravely preparing himself for the ultimate penalty, who is doing everything possible to make a good showing on the scaffold, and who, meanwhile, is carried off by a flu epidemic.
What's Sartre's point here? He accepts that even when we're gravely ill, we still can conduct ourselves with courage and self-acceptance, much as his condemned prisoner does. As a matter of fact, Sartre conducted himself with exemplary courage near his own end, continuing to work in the face of his blindness and declining health. Sartre suggests, however, that our conduct in the face of imminent death is really a form of life, one way, among others, in which we can give meaning to the limits we encounter in our lives. Choosing to conduct our last days in a certain way is thus a comprehensible project. To project a particular kind of death, say heroism or suicide, might even be comprehensible. But our particular individual deaths are different. Death itself is different. It can't be anticipated or chosen. It can't even be conceived. It's totally devoid of meaning. As Sartre puts it, death is not one possibility among others. It destroys all possibilities. It will simply happen. And when death occurs, the dying person will not be the one to give it meaning. The survivors will determine what meaning it has.
Furthermore, death, insofar as it can be revealed to me, is not only the always possible negation of my possibles, a negation outside my possibilities. It is not only the project which destroys all projects and which destroys itself, the impossible destruction of my expectations. It is also the triumph of the point of view of the other over the point of view which I am toward myself. Thus, the very existence of death alienates us wholly in our own life to the advantage of the other. To be dead is to be prey to the living. It is to owe them one's meaning.
The living will decide what we will have been. Thus, death haunts each of our projects as their inevitable reverse side. Death could come at any time from outside and turn us over to the outside. Death takes our projects from us and makes them the objects of other people's projects elsewhere.
Thus, death is not an obstacle to my projects. It is only a destiny of those projects elsewhere. And this is not because death does not limit my freedom, but because freedom never encounters this limit. The fact of death simply makes it that I am a free mortal.
For Sartre, then, death itself is not fearful. Death is just empty, the limit of our existence. We can't arm ourselves against it. So, in a certain way, the fact of death leaves our freedom as it is. As long as we live, we still must define the meaning of our lives. For this reason, Sartre concludes that our responsibility is total.
The essential consequence of our view is that man, being condemned to be free, carries the weight of the whole world on his shoulders. He is responsible for the world and for himself as a way of being. The most terrible situations of war, the worst tortures, do not create a non-human state of things. There is no non-human situation. It is only through fear, flight, and recourse to magical types of conduct that I shall decide on the non-human. But this decision is human, and I shall carry the entire responsibility for it.
Thus, Sartre continues,
there are no accidents in a life. A community event which suddenly bursts forth and involves me in it does not come from outside. If I am mobilized in a war, this war is my war. It is in my image, and I deserve it. I deserve it, first, because I could always get out of it, by suicide or by desertion. These ultimate possibles are those which must always be present for us when there is a question of envisaging a situation. For lack of getting out of it, I have chosen it.
In a sense, therefore, you even choose the meaning of your own birth.
For this fact of my birth never appears as a brute fact, but always across a projective reconstruction of my for itself. I am ashamed of being born, or I am astonished at it, or I rejoice over it, or in attempting to get rid of my life, I affirm that I live and I assume this life as bad.
You can't avoid total and complete responsibility for your life. This is the thesis of Sartre's existentialism.
This is the end of part 7. Please download part 8 to continue.